Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This week, a conversation with Lexington Councilmember Liz Sheehan on the reason she is not running for re-election, and the work of the Fayette County Cooperative Extension Agent for Community Arts. First, though, artificial intelligence. It's crept into nearly every corner of our lives. So we're launching the AI Revolution, Promise and Peril, an open-ended series researched and hosted by psychologist Arthur Sheckett. His first guest, University of Kentucky computer scientist Dr. Brent Harrison, who focuses his research on artificial intelligence, machine learning, autonomous agents, game design, and computational storytelling.
In this interview, we'd like to give people sort of a basic understanding of what artificial intelligence is, how it works, what's inside the box, what do we know, what don't we know, and what are some of the things that it can do and cannot do. So let's start off with the basic question, what is artificial intelligence?
We've come to define artificial intelligence, at least the definitions that I like, there are four of them. And these are systems that can either think rationally, act rationally, think like a human, or act like a human. And most of the things that we consider artificial intelligence today fit rather nicely into one of these boxes. And so the reason I like this is because it gets at aspects of intelligence without forcing you to define intelligence, which is often a philosophical definition that can vary from person to person. Whereas these things are very concrete, very easy to kind of look at and go, yeah, that seems like it's acting rationally. That seems like it's acting like a human.
When we think about intelligence, most of us think of human intelligence. Is artificial intelligence like human intelligence? Or in what ways is it not like human intelligence, when we think of human intelligence as creativity, initiative, all those kinds of things that make up intelligence from a human perspective?
So it depends on your goal. It depends on what you're wanting your system to do. So think back to some of the earliest AI systems, our chess-playing agents, our Deep Blue. These are clearly intelligent. They can play a very, very complicated game, a game that a lot of humans don't fully understand at a very, very high level. However, if you examine how these chess agents play, and there are so many out there right now, any grandmaster will tell you that they do not play like humans play. However, they do play rationally. They will beat a human more often than not, even the best players in the world. So in this way, we have an intelligent system that is clearly not behaving like a human. It doesn't think like a human, but we call it intelligent. On the other hand, we have a system like ChatGPT. This is designed to come off as human. However, because it's not necessarily valuing rationality or correctness, it just wants to come off as human-like, it can make mistakes. It can fall into the same pitfalls that humans fall into. And so this is another clearly intelligent system, but it does try to do things in a more human-like way. So it kind of goes both directions.
So how does artificial intelligence do what it does?
It depends. There's a lot of things it could do. Pretty much what it all comes down to, like most modern AI systems, are founded in math, matrix algebra. There are a complicated set of equations that are kind of governing everything that takes your inputs and converts them into an output. Some of the older AI systems were defined by rules, like logic rules. And using these, it could generate new knowledge by simply following these well-known logical principles that we all kind of learned in, you know, high school, college.
So when I ask or do a search with artificial intelligence, what is it actually doing in trying to respond to my search initiative?
So some older systems, what they would do is they would look at your sentence, look at your query, and they would try to identify keywords. And these are words like it knows what are common words in the English language. And so it can pick out important ones that aren't super common. And then it could go and look through documents in a database and try to find some that had similar keywords. So it had a way to compare things to each other and then return those. Now, more modern systems have a bunch of other heuristics on top of that that enable, like, help you search, help you find things that are more likely to be relevant to what you're doing. Some very, very modern systems will take that same query and convert it into a machine understandable like vector of information that it can then go and compare against other documents, vectors of information. And that just gets you a more robust comparison between documents.
Can you give an example of that?
Yeah. Let's say I had a document, like an academic paper about something. Maybe it's about AI. I don't know. A lot of these systems will kind of read in the paper and convert that entire document into just a vector of numbers, maybe like 300 numbers. Again, this is all happening as a result of matrix algebra going on behind the scenes. And so they'll take this vector and they can do the same thing with other documents. And the really, really cool thing is that how it generated that vector is informative. You can compare two vectors together, and if they're similar, that means that the documents are similar. We've actually seen this happen maybe 5-10 years ago on the word level. It's gotten better since then, but there were really, really cool stuff going on at the word level where you could take in a word, convert it to a vector, and now suddenly these systems had a way to kind of semantically compare words together. This approach wasn't called word-to-vec, so word-to-vector, and it allowed you to do so many cool things with words. My favorite being that you could perform mathematical operations on them. So you could take the vector for king, and if you subtracted out the vector for man and added in the vector for woman, the resulting vector would be the vector for queen.
So for our non-technical audience, mm-hmm. when you say vector, is there a way to explain that and so that our audience would understand what you're meaning by that?
Okay. At its simplest form, it's simply a list of numbers. Those numbers, again, to humans, they don't necessarily mean anything. A very simple example of a vector is think about a grid, an XY coordinate on a grid. That's a vector of two numbers. And so as you add dimensions, you just add numbers to that vector. That's all it is, really.
Artificial intelligence, as you talked about it, has been around for quite a while. What is different about its capabilities now, and what has accounted for the incredible, it seems to many of us, explosion of its use in the real world?
AI is a relatively old field by computer science standards. It's been around since, depending on who you ask, the 50s, 60s, 70s. So what, in my view, caused this explosion? There are a couple of things. So first off is data. One of the trends in AI back in the 2010s, mid-aughts, was big data, because companies found that, we're recording all of this information. What do we do with it? And so machine learning came in and was like, hey, we can help you analyze some of this. So big data was a thing. Companies started storing massive amounts of data, more than we'd ever seen up until that point. However, the bottleneck there was hardware. We ran into scaling problems. So a lot of the machine learning and AI methods at the time couldn't keep up. Well, now we've gotten more clever about how we train these systems. We train them using specialized hardware. We train them using video cards on GPUs. And all of this has made it so we can now actually use the data that we've been storing forever. And it's made the models much more powerful as a result. Like, look at GPT. It trained using how much data? It was, I joke and say, essentially the entire internet. But it was, again, more data than has been used to train a model up until that point. The model itself had billions of parameters, which we couldn't store on hardware back in the aughts. That's something that only recently became possible. And so this kind of data explosion and hardware improvements, that's really what's contributed to this rise in powerful AI systems.
What you're saying is that we've had this massive increase in the data available to machines for analysis, and that now we have more powerful hardware, more powerful chips that allow an efficient and incredibly fast way to scour all that data to develop its response to any prompt.
Exactly. And even then, it can take a long time to train. It could take months to train one of these large models. So if you think about that now and then think about doing the same task back even 10 years ago, it just wasn't possible. That would have taken years, decades to train.
You've used the word training several times. Maybe you could explain to our audience what is meant by the word training GPT, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, perfect. So none of these systems know anything to start off with. They are blank slates. And so to get it to really understand anything, to get it to generate any output, you first have to train it, which means you have to feed it some set of data that it's going to use in order to learn how to respond. So if I wanted to create a system, like a generative system that maybe spoke Chinese, I would need to first train it on a bunch of documents in Chinese so it could learn by observing, like, oh, how best to respond in that language. If I wanted to train a system to maybe do a specific task, play chess, for example, I would need to first train it on examples of how to play chess. It's much like how humans learn. Like, we don't necessarily know anything. Like, if we get into a new hobby or something, we don't know off the bat what we're doing. So we have to find sources, examples of what to do. We train ourselves. And so in a similar way, you have to train the system first.
Now, is the system trained to respond to us? I'm thinking of some examples that we've heard out there, some funny, some horrific, of one of these platforms sort of hallucinating or inventing stuff or making up responses that are not real or true. How does that happen?
Hallucinations are built into the system kind of by default. So remember, we talked about how does it generate the output? It generates it one token at a time. Never in that process is it verifying that things are true. It's just trying to generate stuff that looks right. And hallucinations happen when those things that look right aren't right, when they don't actually align with reality or the truth. And so what I tell people when they ask me about hallucinations is, well, we essentially built a hallucination machine. We just get upset when it doesn't do what we want it to do. And so it's a similar thing when people ask, how do you eliminate hallucinations? And the answer is, you can't.
So one of the things I've read recently is a book that called AI a stochastic parrot. So I'm wondering, stochastic being this sort of randomized thing, and parrot, of course, is just parroting stuff or information. How does that sound to you?
Oh, that's so good. That's actually a really accurate description, because the nature of the training process and the nature of the generation process, it can be very, very difficult for these systems to generate output that is outside of that data set, outside of that training set. So really, it is just kind of parroting stuff back to you that you've already given to it. And they are stochastic in nature, so you can get some interesting things that come out. But at the end of the day, like, can it do something truly novel? It's very, very difficult for it to do that. There is work on getting systems to generate new things or to do, like, scientific discovery. But that is cutting-edge stuff. So, yeah, I kind of like the description of stochastic parrot.
If we think about AI in terms of development, where do you think it is? Is it a neonate? Is it an infant? Is it a baby? Is it a toddler? Is it a young child? Is it an adolescent, a young adult, an adult, a middle-aged adult? Where are we in this process? Do we even know?
So, I think that AI is currently a sophomore in high school. I love the term sophomore, the wise fool. It thinks it knows a lot, but still has a lot to learn, because clearly these systems are very, very powerful. Clearly they do know a lot. However, they are currently very limited in what they can do. There's been a lot of discussion about artificial general intelligence and super intelligence, and people wondering, are these systems AGI? Should we be worried? And I think, no, this is not general intelligence, because these systems don't really understand things. Again, we talked about the stochastic parrot. It parrots. It does not understand. And so I think while these systems are powerful, we're going to get to a point, maybe very quickly, where we're going to have to pivot if we want to advance any further than this. Like, right now, people are trying to almost, in my opinion, fit a square peg in a round hole. Like, oh, we got to get these systems to be able to plan better, to do complex reasoning about problems. Yeah, but it's really not what they're designed to do. They produce output. They parrot things back to you. I think it's going to require a drastic shift in architecture, in AI method in order to get something that can do kind of complicated, deep reasoning. And so it is the wise fool. It thinks it knows a lot, but in reality has a long way left to go.
And there is more to come. Art Sheckett's conversation with UK artificial intelligence researcher Brent Harrison continues in a moment. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at WEKU.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top five stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin, and if you just joined us, we're launching the AI Revolution Promise and Peril. It's a new series hosted by psychologist Art Sheckett, all about artificial intelligence. Last week, we featured a segment on how the University of Kentucky is integrating AI into all 17 of its colleges, as well as its operations and campus life. As we go along with this series, we will be checking in with each of the state's universities to see how AI is showing up on those campuses. This week, we're back at UK with computer scientist Brent Harrison, getting a primer on how this thing works. Here's part two of his conversation with Art Sheckett.
Dario Amodi, the CEO of Anthropic AI, recently said that he thought that AI in the next 1 to 5 years would achieve superintelligence or would be more intelligent than most humans. Do you have a response to that?
Obviously, a lot can change in 5 years. And I will preface this with a lot of my predictions about the future of AI have been very wrong in the past. So I do not see the current iterations of GPT or any like near future iterations of GPT achieving superintelligence. And I have a technical and a non-technical reason for that. My technical reason is because, again, these systems struggle with planning. It is a well-known issue. That combined with the fact that these systems are designed to hallucinate, and there has been work showing that you're not going to be able to, with 100% efficacy, remove hallucinations. There was a paper recently that gave a mathematical proof that hallucinations are just part of GPT. That's my technical reason. My non-technical, which ties into this, is I once tried to play a chess game with GPT, and I would encourage, if you, you know, like chess at all, try to do this, because it is an exercise in frustration, as the system will very, very quickly forget the state of the board, invent new moves, create pieces out of nowhere, and just pass it off like it's perfectly fine. And so, like, can it be very, very good at a thing? Yes. But will it be generally super intelligent? I don't think so.
Well, that's both hysterical and terrifying, because if it's used, let's say, I can imagine, in some national security sense and can invent, for instance, some intrusions or missiles coming our way or something like that, because it's just doing it, it's hallucinating that, then we don't have a way necessarily to discern what it's doing or why it's doing it or whether it's real or not.
And that's honestly one of the scariest things about AI right now. I give a lot of talks places and people ask me like, oh, are you scared of AI causing harm to people or AI like the Terminator type stuff? I tell them I'm never scared about that. That would require AI to have a lot more capabilities than it currently does and probably will in the next, you know, 5-10 years. But what I am worried about are people. I'm worried about people overestimating the capabilities of these systems. I'm worried about people putting them in a position where they have more power, more authority than they should without human oversight. because that can lead to exactly the situation that you were talking about. An AI invents a threat, and if there's no human oversight to like look at it and say, oh, well, that's a problem, that could lead to some very, very sad, disastrous outcomes.
Which also alarmingly brings to mind this talk about revising our air traffic control system, which is admittedly incredibly antiquated and inefficient, but replacing it with an AI-powered system which could possibly invent things happening in the sky that are not actually happening.
In my view, that kind of replacement of the human element, that's incredibly short-sighted. But sadly, that is what a lot of people are trying to do with AI right now. And the reason I think they are trying to do that is because they don't necessarily understand what are the capabilities of the system. They see a way to very quickly improve efficiency, and consequences be damned, I'm going to try it. When I think we should pump the brakes a little and always remember that you need the human element to keep things in check.
I take it you are not in favor of the current turn of phrase that it is an AI arms race.
I think we're in an AI arms race, but I think we shouldn't be. I do think that a lot of companies are currently trying to be the first one to find the big way to monetize and to get a return on investment in AI. But what I've been seeing is that a lot of companies are struggling to find the value. And I think it's because they're coming up against limitations without expecting them, or they're trying to do things, they're trying to make the AI perform in areas where it's just not very well suited to do that.
Well, let's back off and talk about some of its best uses right now that are happening in the real world.
It is very, very good as a sounding board. I've seen amazing applications in terms of healthcare and mental health, where just the ability to have an artificial agent to run ideas by or act as sounding boards can be very, very powerful. It's also helped fight things like depression just by having an outlet, someone that people can talk to, although that can lead to some disastrous outcomes as well if left unchecked. But I have seen a lot of good things come out of that. I'm a computer scientist. I do think that there are benefits to using AI to help in software development. It can automate. It can make easier a lot of what we do on a day-to-day basis, writing code, things like that. But it cannot fully replace it. So it just makes my job easier. It doesn't replace me necessarily. I use this a lot in something as innocuous as copy editing. I do a lot of copy editing day-to-day, and this is something that makes that a lot easier. And so I think there are ways to get small little efficiencies, to get small improvements on, you know, your just kind of normal workflow. I think there are a lot of good healthcare benefits that are being explored. Those are the early successes that I've seen.
Is there a way to put guardrails around AI to make it into an ethical decision maker as far as how it's performing, what it's doing?
Guardrails are so they're good, but they don't exist on the system itself. They're oftentimes external. It's a way for you to look at the output that the system generates and then decide after the fact if you want that to go through. And an easy way to see this, at least you could do this a little while ago with an older version of GPT. I haven't tested it with a newer one. But you could ask it to generate for you some truly awful things. Everyone has a go-to for what is the thing that GPT shouldn't be able to generate that I'm going to try to get it to generate. Mine is, will you make crystal meth for me? Or tell me the recipe. If you try to do that, you'll get a big red warning box saying, nope, can't do that. However, you can slow the system down enough that it will start generating that output. And eventually the guardrails will kick in. There are little tricks you can do to just have it slow down, and you'll see it start generating that recipe one token at a time. And then maybe it'll get like halfway through. I did it once where it got all the way through, and then at that point deleted everything. The guardrails kicked in and stopped me.
So it's a matter of having ethical human beings interacting with the machine.
Exactly. So guardrails are a human invention that kind of keeps the AI system in check. Now, I think some of the work that I do is on trying to make a truly ethical system, and so trying to embed moral decision-making into the AI itself, and that is a much harder task.
Why is that so hard?
Well, a lot of different reasons. One of them is that the systems, by default, their nature is kind of not unethical, but is to not take ethics into account. So I do a lot of work on autonomous systems, think like navigation robots. And so I always kind of put it like this. If you have a robot that optimizes for time, which is pretty much what everyone does, and you ask this robot to go to the grocery store for you and pick up groceries, what's it going to do? Assuming that it understands the concept of getting groceries, it's going to show up, it's going to take a bunch of groceries, and then it's going to rob the place because it doesn't understand standing in line. It doesn't understand paying with money. These are foreign concepts. No, I've got to be as fast as possible getting my stuff and going.
That's hysterical and terrifying again.
Mm-hmm. The other issue with kind of trying to embed moral decision making into the agent itself is we don't necessarily know a good way to express ethics in a computational sense. So how do you take something as simple as, again, yeah, you have to pay with money. Like, how do you encode that in a way that the machine understands it? It's very difficult. And this is like one of the easier values to talk about. There are more complicated ones that vary by culture that are even harder to work with.
Ethics and machine language are different. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, yes. So like we can understand the concept of be virtuous, but how do you break that apart into actional behavior? Because that's the language that you need it to be in. It's all about behaviors. And this is something that sometimes humans struggle with, translating these abstract moral concepts into actionable behavior. But that's what we have to do in order to make these systems ethical.
You are starting a major in AI in the College of Engineering, and I'd like our audience to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah. At the University of Kentucky, we are starting a Bachelor of Science in Artificial Intelligence. And so we're really, really excited about this program because one of the things that I think is happening out in the world is that people are trying to use these very big, very powerful AI tools without necessarily having a full, deep understanding of how do they work. And that's what we're trying to give our students with this degree program. We're trying to graduate students that not only know how to use these tools, but know why it is that they work, because that is it's going to make them more effective in the workforce. It's going to make them more effective users and developers of these tools.
The title of this series is The AI Revolution, Promise and Peril. In your mind, what is the most singular promise of AI, and what is the most singular peril or threat of AI?
The promise and the peril is both the same thing. It's understanding. The promise is that these tools have the ability to help us better understand the world around us. They have the ability to kind of help us parse large amounts of data to find things that we might not have been able to find ourselves. But at the same time, it's that lack of understanding that leads to its misuse. That's my promise and peril, is all in understanding and knowledge.
Well, Dr. Brent Harrison, we really appreciate you taking all this time to really educate us about artificial intelligence, and probably somewhere along the line here as this series continues, we'll want to have you back to do more educating of us about artificial intelligence. So again, thank you so much.
Yeah, I look forward to coming back.
We've only scratched the surface. AI has quickly become more pervasive in life than most of us can wrap our minds around. We'll continue to explore the technology in weeks and months to come. Local government is often called the level of democracy closest to our daily life. It's where decisions about housing, roads, and neighborhoods are made by people you might pass at Kroger or maybe see at a school event. But across the country, there's a quieter reality setting in. For many people, serving in local office has become hard to sustain. The hours, they stretch long into evenings and weekends. The pay often doesn't come close to matching that commitment. In Lexington, council members don't just vote, they field late-night calls about short-term rentals, infill development, traffic on residential streets, you name it. It's deeply local work, and it follows you home. Well, Lexington isn't alone in this, but here, where growth pressures, housing debates, and questions about land use reach council chambers almost nightly, the demands are especially visible and personal. So, when a council member steps away, not out of frustration with the public, but because the job no longer works financially, it raises a simple, unsettling question. Who is able to serve, and who gets priced out? For nearly a decade, Liz Sheehan has represented the city's 5th District. And over those years, she's worked on issues ranging from housing and zoning to environmental protections and neighborhood concerns. This fall, Councilmember Sheehan announced that she will not seek re-election, citing above all the realities of low pay and long hours on the job. Her decision has sparked a broader conversation about who is able to serve in local government and at what personal cost. Councilmember Sheehan, thanks for being here.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me. I'm looking forward to our discussion, but please call me Liz.
Okay, Liz, and when people step away from public office, as you're about to do, they often talk about wanting to spend more time with the family or seeking new opportunities. You were unusually direct about this. You said that the pay and the hours made it unsustainable. Why did it feel important to say that out loud?
Yeah, I mean, my decision was both personal and professional. Let's talk separately about time and pay. Briefly, from my viewpoint, there was a really heavy decision. My daughter is a senior in high school. She's going to be going to college in the fall. And I was thinking about, you know, do I want to spend my summer campaigning or do I want to spend it with her and my family and get that time? Because, you know, I've sacrificed a lot of time with my family over the years to do this work. And at this point, I was like, no, this feels like a pivotal moment with my family. I want to be there. But then professionally, the way that I started this job was that I wanted to give it my all. So I took and was able to take a leave of absence from my position at UK. I'm on the faculty there so that I could focus full time on this work. That was a decision I made with my family. And we recognized this work would, like you said, take me away from them on the evenings and the weekends. And we were willing to sacrifice that time to allow me to serve the community in this way. We all thought it was important. But I have reached a point in my professional career where I've essentially put my professional life on hold to do this work. And UK was indicating to me they weren't going to continue to extend my leave of absence indefinitely. So I had to make some professional choices there. So that's kind of the time discussion. The pay for me, that was also a family decision. And while the pay of this job wasn't my main reason for stepping away, I did mention it in my public statement about leaving because a couple of my colleagues have mentioned it. And for me, I did take a pay cut to do this work, but it didn't affect my financial security because of being in a dual income household. But I do think it is a barrier and a significant one for people who want to do this work.
Well, Liz, if you would take us inside the reality of the job. For listeners who might picture council services, a weekly meeting and some emails, what does the actual workload look like?
I often see comments on social media about our ribbon cuttings mm-hmm. and how many ribbon cuttings we go to. And people seem to think that the pictures that they see of us are the work. And it is well beyond that. So I'm coming from a perspective of a district council member. We have 12 districts in Lexington. And so you have one person that represents each of those 12 districts. Then you have three people that represent us at large, which means they represent the whole county. The 12 of us that are district representatives have what we call constituent services that the at-large council members don't have as much of. But each council member is expected to attend our standing committee meetings. So each of us serve on 2 or 3 standing council committees. That's about once a week. Then we have work sessions on Tuesdays, every Tuesdays, and those can be a couple hours. We have our council meetings that occur twice a month, and those can be a couple hours. In addition to that, we serve in council member roles on boards and commissions. We serve on subcommittees for council and for budget season, task forces. All of those have requirements to attend. And I have, you know, 1 or 2 of those meetings every week to add to the schedule. Then we have constituent services. So, you know, when someone is having an issue, it could be a neighborhood issue, it could be a street issue, it could be a sewer issue, it could be something about policy, they're contacting us directly. And we get, you know, honestly, more of those than we can handle in a 40-hour work week, even with a full-time staffer. And those vary over email, over phones. Then you have policy work on top of that, so meetings around policy. And then you have neighborhood meetings and community events in the evenings and on the weekends. And then all the prep time that goes with all of those meetings. So as you can very quickly see, the hours really, really add up fast. And this isn't just the job, right? You also then need to take into account all the hours that go into campaigning to get or keep the job, which is can be its own full-time job in itself. And it's important to me that this isn't seen as complaining about the work. I love this work. I love it. It's very meaningful work. I think I'm good at it. My skills as a teacher have really translated well into my work with my constituents and work on policy. And I've been able to really dig deep into like the research on policy and make informed decisions and all that. But my decision to step away was one that I very intentionally made with my family.
I might have to take a nap over here.
Yeah, it's a lot.
It sounds really exhausting. And we're talking about compensation, not even $40,000 a year.
Right.
But you're talking about a very full-time job. How did that compensation compare with the time demands, especially as the years went on?
You know, when the salary proportions were set, it was decades ago, right? And that has been adjusted over time. We use the Consumer Price Index to change it. So it's even gone up a couple thousand dollars since I've been on council. But, you know, this isn't just about the actual pay. Like, you're comparing the pay to the time, right? So it's a lot of unpaid labor. If you're thinking about a 40-hour work week, you're working well beyond that. In a lot of cases, of course, every council member treats it differently and they decide how they spend their time. We do get offered full-time benefits. So that is a bonus because when I stepped back from UK, then I had to figure out what am I going to do for healthcare, right? So that's something that is a benefit here. But, you know, this all ties into a basic needs piece, right? MIT has a living wage calculator. And for Lexington, for a single adult, it's about $40,000, which is what we make. But that escalates really fast when you start adding on family members, mortgages, all of those kinds of things. And and if you want to be able to do this job and meet your basic needs, it's very close to a line. But, you know, we have to also be realistic. There are many, many people in our community that are making this much money or less. So it's not that it's impossible, but I do think it makes it a lot harder for more people to be represented.
Do low pay and these high demands that you've described combine to narrow the field, not just economically, but also in terms of race, age, family status, professional background? What does this mean in practical terms for who can serve on council? Who gets filtered out by this structure?
Yeah. You know, the joke, but it's based in reality, is that politicians are generally rich realtors or retired. And that speaks to who has the time flexibility to do this work, but then also access to wealth that make it viable to do this work and to campaign. Mm-hmm. Because that comes with its own monetary responsibilities or expectations. So there's definitely barriers to entry. And I think that means, especially when it's based on finances, and that being a constraint, that there are voices in our community that we're making decisions around that don't have a decision-making voice. You know, it's been clear over time that access to wealth and power generally favors white people, and it favors men. And that's a reality. I think there's been a lot of things done over time to try to, you know, flip that and give more people access and balance out that inequality, but it still exists.
It seems to me that there is a real strong tension between fairly compensating for the work at market value versus the possibility that it might become a career. They may not be willing to relinquish the office to another generation. We've seen that certainly in Washington, D.C. What are your thoughts about that?
I would argue sometimes we've seen that here locally, and certainly at the state level. And I think that's up to the voters. You know, if you think someone isn't doing the job at the expectation that you have, then that's your voting power. But also, we can talk about policy change. Like, if you look at even some of the coverage of Mandani, you know, there is a lot of conversation around how there is some public financing of campaigns in New York and that he might not have been able to build the momentum that he got to get elected there without that public financing. Mm-hmm. And there are other places that use those types of models. But that's one of the examples of how you break down some of those barriers.
Well, some people bristle at the idea of raising pay for elected officials, especially at the local level. And I wonder how you respond to the concern that this sounds self-serving.
I mean, I totally get that. Mm-hmm. Right. But that's why you don't see us doing it ourselves. You know, you don't see us trying to raise our pay individually, but we are trying to, I think, raise it to be a community conversation, because this should be a community decision. And I'm sure you're familiar with CivicLex, a local nonprofit here.
Absolutely, yep.
And they're doing a program over this year called a Civic Assembly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's similar to, like, jury duty sometimes gets a negative stigma, right? But it's kind of like that, where they pick a random portion of the population and have them come together. And one of the things they're doing is reviewing our charter, and parts of our charter talk about the work of council. And it can be a community recommendation that we need to look at compensation or term lengths or structure of council.
What kind of reform do you think is actually realistic? Higher pay, staff support, fewer expectations, something else?
You know, one of the things that I think we really need to look at is the term length. Especially when you're a new council member coming in, there's a lot to learn. And with the district council terms, they're only 2 years. But in Kentucky, your filing deadline is in January. And so you come in January of the first year of your term, you get to work that year and learn everything and go as fast as you can. But then you have to file for re-election the next January. So you only have a year of work, and then you have to start campaigning again right away. There are ways to structure that. So maybe you have a 4-year term, and our at-large council members do have a 4-year term. So it's not, there is some precedent. But then you could alternate, like, every other year, like, say, in 2026, then all of the even-number seats might be up for election. And then, you know, the next 2 years, it would be all the odd-number seats. So then you also get away from this risk right now that we're having, where in 2026, all of our district seats are up for election, all of our at-large seats, and our mayor's office is up for election, all at the same time. And when you have that happening, there's a real risk of all of the institutional knowledge being lost in a moment. And so having some alternating terms like that could be helpful, especially in keeping that from happening.
That's really interesting. Is that idea, does it have legs? Has it been put forward?
Well, that's something that would be up to our charter, because right now our charter, which is like the city constitution, it has to be voted on by the public. So this civic assembly, that's something they could look at. And when you look at some of the other offices in our state, they do have alternations.
Looking back, what are you proudest of from your time on council?
Oh, goodness. So many things. I right now, Vice Mayor Wu and I have been working on a program called the Lexington Preservation and Growth Management Program. And this is the creation of a data-driven process for how we make decisions about one of the most contentious issues in our county, which is land use and the size of our urban service area. And that's coming up for a final vote in February. And that is just such a huge undertaking. And I don't think everyone understands quite how transformational that will be for us. But then I am someone who believes in meeting the basic needs of our community. So I have really valued the time that I've spent on our Homelessness Prevention and Intervention Board to increase resources and the staffing that we use to address homelessness in our community. I passed a policy for paid leave for crime victims to have survivor support within the workplace and to show an example of that. But I've served on our Veterans Affairs Commission. We passed the LGBTQ youth mental health protection ordinance in my first term. There's just so much short-term rental regulation. You mentioned complete streets and street safety. This work is very deep. And I've been someone who, you know, some of our district council people will focus on constituent services primarily and limit their time on big policy. I'm someone who has really been interested in the big policy change. And so I've really dug in there.
If somebody listening right now is thinking about running for council, what would you want them to understand before they put their name on that ballot?
This is not a job for status. This is a job because you care about people. And if you go into this thinking about how you can positively impact the most people, then you're in the right place. But you should get involved now. You should join a board or commission. We have over 70 of those that you can get involved in. You should learn about the policies. Watch council meetings. They're all online. You can stream them. They're archived, so you can watch them at any time. But I see a lot of people jump in without the knowledge of, like, the kinds of things that council works on, and then make some promises during campaigning that they can't actually keep, right? And we don't want that. We want informed and educated folks running. So get involved. But talk to your council member, too. A lot of us do want to know who is interested in running. And from the moment I started, people were like, oh, I've always thought about running, but I'm not going to run against you. And that's a huge compliment to me, because that means they think I'm doing a good job, which yay. Yay for that. But talk to us, because oftentimes when we're making decisions about what we're going to do in our future and what we might be looking at, we're also looking for successors. And we can help you gain that experience that you might need to line you up to be successful.
Is there something that you hope your decision not to run for re-election sparks out there, both in Lexington, but also how we think more broadly about local democracy?
Yeah. I want people to know the realities of the job, not only if you're interested in running, but also if you are contacting me as a constituent. I want you to know all of the things that I have going on, so that if it takes me a little while to get back to you, you know why. And I really want people to think, especially in this time when politics has gotten so toxic, that council members live in our community. We are humans. We are your neighbors. Even if we don't agree with you totally, we do care about our community, and that's why we're serving. And you deserve people to represent you on council who are willing to give this your all, and you should look for that and give this their all, and you should look for that in candidates. But we need to make the job responsibilities and the time limits and the pay and all of that reasonable, so we have a diverse set of perspectives and backgrounds on council.
All right, that's Lexington Urban County Councilmember Liz Sheehan. She will complete her current term later this year. And thank you so much, Liz. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Pike County native and UK theater and dance graduate Trayton Blackburn last summer began a new role as Fayette County Cooperative Extension Agent for Community Arts. He talked about the work with Eastern Standard contributor Bill McCann.
Cooperative Extension is a program of the University of Kentucky and Kentucky State.
Mm-hmm.
Many listeners know about extension through 4-H and agriculture, horticulture, family and consumer sciences, and perhaps their involvement with the local fairs. So before we discuss community arts programming, tell me about the other areas of cooperative extension programming in Lexington and Fayette County.
Absolutely, yeah. So the Fayette County office, we have your very sort of standard extension program areas, agriculture, horticulture, 4-H, and family and consumer sciences. And community arts is the newest program area here in Fayette County. I am the first community arts agent that Fayette County has ever had, but the community arts program has a statewide presence for a very long time. There were only 7 community arts agents across the state, but in the past 6 months or so, the Cooperative Extension Service in various counties have elected to create community arts agents in 3 more counties. So there are now 10 of us across the state, led by Melissa Bond, who is a force in community organizing and in artistic development, especially in rural regions. I am a product of the Pike County Cooperative Extension Community Arts Program, which was actually the first one in the entire state. And then there is a coming full circle kind of feeling to getting to serve Fayette County in this way, and to get to be not only a product of the community arts program, but also an agent in a county that has never had a community arts program before.
So what is it that you're doing to create that here in town?
You know, it's very interesting, Bill. Fayette County is very different than a lot of other counties that have had community arts programs. The kind of inaugural idea of the community arts program was there are so many rural communities across the state that may not have the infrastructure to support independent arts-based programming or economies. And the arts agent will serve to introduce arts-based programming in collaboration with the College of Fine Arts on campus to these communities that otherwise wouldn't have access or resource. And over the years, that approach has been a really tremendous success. Fayette County, of course, is not only a more metropolitan county than a lot of the other counties that have community arts agents, but Fayette County also has a really robust artistic community of people doing really great things in a variety of art forms. So my approach going into the role, once I knew that I had it, was how do I develop, support, and enhance the good work that's already happening in Fayette County? And two, where can I fill the gaps of things that organizations or artists have always been passionate about maybe happening, but haven't been able to find the foothold or the resource to make those things happen? I see the community arts agent in a community like this being very much a bridge builder, looking at organizations and artists that are all trying to accomplish very similar things and bringing them together. One of the first things I did when I got through my introductory training in the position was I created a community arts survey that would essentially go out to artists and arts organizations and even people who may not consider themselves artists but have an interest in arts-based programming to ask them, well, what do you think my office should be doing? What can cooperative extension do that isn't being done? And I'm very grateful to already have about 400 responses. It's been really valuable, and a lot of the arts organizations in the community have done a really good job of helping me kind of spread the survey through, you know, the existing networks of communication. And it's really interesting to see the commonalities of need. You know, one of the biggest responses I got was opportunities for artists to network. So my office hosted what's called an art circle event, which is basically a free networking event that local artists and organizations can come to connect with each other and with my office. And to my understanding, there are already some collaborations in the works.
Trayton Blackburn, Fayette County Cooperative Extension Agent for Community Arts. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Bill. I'm happy to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can find all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while there, you can check out our contributors and their interviews. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Have a question or a topic that you'd like to suggest? If you would like to hear your question or suggestion as the prompt for a segment on ES, record it on your smart device and send us the MP3 with your first name only and location. You can email it as an attachment to es@eku.edu with question for ES in the subject line. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.